From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here this week while Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actor and director Austin Pendleton. His varied career includes roles on Miami Vice and St. Elsewhere, and directing Elizabeth Taylor in the Broadway production of Little Foxes. Also today, I speak with Cynthia Heimel. Her columns in Playboy and The Village Voice poke fun at modern relationships. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Belmonts, the singers who started out as backup for Dion in the 60s, but went on to have their own career. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Mysteries of Pittsburgh by Michael Chabon. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest, Austin Pendleton, directed Elizabeth Taylor on Broadway in The Little Foxes. He was the original model the Taylor in Fiddler on the Roof. He's played Mark Antony in Julius Caesar and appeared on the TV show St. Elsewhere. This diverse career has spanned more than 25 years in the theater. Now, Pendleton continues to move between acting and directing and between live theater and TV and film. He's currently the associate director of the Williamstown Theater Festival and a member of Chicago Steppenwolf Theater. You might remember seeing him in one of his television roles on Miami Vice, St. Elsewhere, The Equalizer, or Spencer for Hire. He's also appeared in many movies, including What's Up, Doc?, The Muppet Movie, Short Circuit, and Catch-22. Pendleton most recently directed the American premiere of Brian Friel's Fathers and Sons at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. Austin Pendleton is a small man with glasses, and he often turns down TV and film offers to play a type of character that he just can't stand.
There's a way that they like to cast me sometime where it's just I'm a total kind of nerd, and it's just kind of a use of me that I don't like. And the character isn't explored at all or anything. It's just meant to be a presence that's kind of odd and funny. And if that's all there is to it, I feel ripped off, and I just don't do it unless I'm very hard up for money, and then I will. You know?
So have you had that danger of being typed?
Oh yeah, I mean I've had an almost perverse career because I've rejected a lot of roles that were in that mold. And I'm very frightened of a TV series for that reason.
What is this type that they keep casting?
Eyeball. And as I get older, kind of, well, wimps, you know. High school principals who are real prissy and fussy and shrill, ridiculous people. And I... Now, if all of that is part of a great role, I mean, a role that is fully explored by the writer, that's something else. But these parts usually aren't that. They're just, I remember saying to my agent once in California, I'm just supposed to play this uptight high school principal so that Richard Dreyfuss can come on and play a scene with me and be this really together guy in contrast. Mm-hmm. And that's all that part is there for. And I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd never do it for me, and I wouldn't expect him to. And I'm not going to do it. I don't mean that he was asking me to do it. It wasn't him. But, I mean, just that's the only reason the role existed. And but on the other hand, if I'd been real hard up for money at that point, I would have done it. So there is that because I have a child. But in the theater, because it isn't usually a question of a lot of money, if you're offered a part like that, you just simply say no.
I was going to say, how do you escape being typed?
You just hold out, and pretty soon people start to offer you things that are more interesting. I've had a lot of parts in the theater that have just been fascinating to me, just wonderful. But very often there are parts that the audience isn't used to, like, seeing a person like me, and so they don't become terrific career moves. If you know what I mean. I mean, even if they go well, they're not like huge career moves of, oh boy, that part was you, that was it. They don't, but I don't care. I like to play them.
Were you a television watcher as a kid?
It was just coming in. I mean, we lived out in the country outside Warren, Ohio. And we didn't get a TV till like 1953 or 54. And out in the country, there were some people who finally, they got one like in 1950. And I was at that time 10 years old.
So just in time for Superman.
And I remember we would go over there on weekends in the evening and watch the Jackie Gleason show, as it was then called, which included the Honeymooners. And we would go over on Monday nights and watch I Love Lucy. And I think those were, and because it was someone else's house, you couldn't go over every night, you know. And but they were the only ones in the neighborhood that had a TV for quite a while, into the early 50s. And so the whole first years of my life had to do with the radio and the movies. I mean, I just was a movie fanatic. I still am.
Do you think radio and maybe even television affected your acting?
No. But, well, yes, TV, yes. Here's how television affected my acting. In the 50s, when we did get our TV, there were a lot of shows, hour-long drama shows live, written by excellent writers like Vidal, you know, Gore Vidal, and Tad Mozell, and Patty Chayefsky, and people like that. And I forget the names of those shows. Oh, Philco Playhouse and things like that. And they were an hour long, and they were every week. And there were like a few of them. And they were out of New York. And the leading roles were always played by actors who were primarily known in New York in the theater, whom I hadn't seen in the movies. People like, you know, Eileen Heckert and Kim Stanley and Joe Van Fleet. And if I'd seen them in the movies at all, it was in supporting roles, but they would play leading. And E.G. Marshall, you know, people like that. And I'd never seen acting like that. I certainly had never seen it in the movies. And the few times I would see a touring show that came to Cleveland, I wouldn't see that. You know, you'd see old-fashioned kind of theatrical acting, either in the movies or in the touring companies. And so I began to see this kind of acting. It was the cream of that, the way American acting was in the 50s, very behavioral and very specific and very real. And I'd never seen anything like it. And I thought, oh, my God. And then, of course, the climax of that was it came to the movies. And I went with a bunch of friends one Saturday afternoon and saw On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. And it had the effect on me that it had on every actor of my age when that film first came out. There had never been a performance like that in the movies that I knew of, that I'd ever seen.
So what did it do to you?
Well, I said, if you can act like that, I want to be an actor. Because it didn't look like, just didn't have that metallic quality that all the other acting I'd ever seen had. And it was the kind of thing I was seeing every week on TV, although even finer. Then I thought, but the trouble is you can't do that in a play. In a play, you have to push it out, and it has to be real theatrical, and who cares, you know. And then one time I went with my mom, who had been a professional actress before she married my dad, and we went up to Cleveland again to see a touring company on a Saturday matinee one spring day of a play called The Rainmaker with Geraldine Page. And that was the first time she had played it on Broadway, and then she was on a tour of it, which was somewhat unusual in those days. I mean, the people who played it on Broadway didn't usually go out on the tours. That was the first time I ever saw that kind of work happen in the theater. The house was maybe a third full. It was a spring, beautiful spring day. I remember it very vividly. And I was at this point about 16. And I remember thinking, it can be done. I'm going to do that. Years later, almost 30 years later, I directed Geraldine Page in a play in New York. And I told her that, in a way, she was responsible for my having become an actor. So the burden had to rest on her.
What did she say?
Well, she liked my acting, so she was very, very pleased. It was a very nice moment. And, I mean, you know, not all people do, but not all people like anybody's acting. But that was, so in a way, yeah, my whole kind of sense of and desire to be an actor was highly influenced by the TV, although the TV of that time wouldn't be influenced by the TV of today. Except, you know, maybe some of the work that goes on in the movies of the week sometime, which is sometimes quite wonderful.
This is actor-director Austin Pendleton. What about television now? Didn't you do an episode or two of Miami Vice?
Oh, I did one of Miami Vice. I did two of St. Elsewhere. I did two of The Equalizer.
Did you like Miami Vice?
I did one of Spencer for Hire. Did I like Miami Vice? Yeah, I liked it. I mean, I loved the part. The part was a real creep. I mean, a really kind of evil little guy. And that was interesting to do. And I liked the director a lot. I liked the two guys, you know, particularly Don Johnson. Don Johnson is the rudest man I have ever met. And I really, really liked him. Because he's just that. I mean, and then once you accept that, you totally communicate on that
level.
Well,
what did he do? What do you mean?
Oh, he throws these little fits all the time. And at one point, I was in the middle of a conversation with him during the middle of an all-night shoot, like at 4 in the morning on some pier in Florida. And in the middle of something I was saying, he just walked away because I guess I lost his interest. Things like that. But it's so out front that then you know when he's relating to you that he's really interested, you know? And I liked him, and I liked his work a lot. I mean, I thought he was excellent. And also, when we were there, he was directing. He had directed the episode that was on the air that week, and it was in the middle of an all-night shoot that it showed. So we were given a dinner break, and we were made to watch this thing while we were eating dinner, and it was beautifully directed. I mean, to a degree that you don't usually find on episodic TV. It was really imaginative, and the quality of the acting was exceptional. And I said to Don, I said, you got to do this. You should be like a big-time feature director and then act if you want to, because he's a good actor. But he's a fascinating man, real angry guy. I presume to say that. I don't really know him at all, but I got that feeling.
That's so interesting.
And proud in his success, as he should be.
Well, what is television doing to stage actors, do you think?
Making them real small. Sometimes. That can happen. It certainly doesn't happen all the time.
What do you mean small?
Well, the choices get real modest and real unadventurous. But when they come back to the stage, that can happen. It certainly doesn't happen all the time. God, I auditioned an actor on Monday who's a regular on a soap opera, and the reading made my hair curl. It was so daring and so electric for a new play I'm directing. And it's, I hope he's going to do it. We offered it to him. And I shouldn't even say these things because they're generalities. And there are actors who... And I don't know whether it has to do with television. This happens to actors who only work in the theater. What happens to some actors is that as they get older, they collapse into themselves and their work becomes very conservative and their approach to it becomes very conservative. And then some actors, as they get older, become increasingly adventurous, both in their choice of roles and in the way they work on the roles they do. And that's the difference. I once said to a class, you know, the only way you define an actor after a while, after the age of like 35 in this profession, is how well they handle their disappointment. Because almost every actor is disappointed. I mean, you enter the theater, the American theater, with such romance, although I'm not sure anybody even does that anymore. But for a long time, they did. And then it just isn't set up to work out. I mean, you're lucky if you get a series. The only really great acting careers in New York, in America right now that are available to people are a certain kind of career in films, like Meryl Streep is the most spectacular example, where you can really do the highest level of work and be well known for it. There's no such thing as an actor who works exclusively in the theater anymore who's extremely well known or you can even raise money on.
How do you handle your disappointment?
I just keep trying to do things that are really interesting to me with people I like. And you get so excited about that while you're doing it that you don't think about anything else. You know, like, I've never taken on myself or I've never been asked to either, the task of trying to run a theater. And I have, as I get older, I have just awe for people who can do that.
Have you ever gotten bitter?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. A lot. There's a lot to get bitter about.
But you don't seem like a bitter type.
It happens. You get really angry sometimes. I mean, sometimes it, I mean, the whole commercial establishment in New York, I feel very bitter about. The critical establishment, I think, is not very, very good right now, or certainly very responsible. Kind of lively, but not, no help, you know what I mean? Everything seems kind of lined up against people who want to do work. And I don't see why that has to be. And I also get very bitter for other people, too. I mean, I just see what people do to people's work and people's kind of careers and lives. And it's just, I mean, the way that really gifted people are trashed and ignored in this business can make you crazy.
My guest is theater director and actor Austin Pendleton. His current production is the American premiere of Brian Friel's Fathers and Sons, which is at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
This is Austin Pendleton, actor and director for stage, film, and television. Well, let's say that you're at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and the TV and film actors are showing up because they want to know that live theater experience again. How do you get them to know what they need to know?
See, I started to say that about how certain actors who've been in TV a lot get conservative, but that also happens to certain theater actors. And it just happens to certain actors that they get real conservative as they go along. And then you just try to shake them loose of it, or you try to play into that virtue. That was the great thing, apparently, Kazan always did as a director. And he, of course, was a great director of actors, as well as, in every way, a great director. But I always heard how he worked with someone the way they wanted to work. And if three different people in a cast worked three different ways, he worked three different ways. Because he played to where the person was secure, and then he would release them into areas that perhaps they wouldn't always go into. But it's not like he pushed them and forced them and to move into something else. But you never, I don't think I've ever had that problem, where because they've been working in TV or film, they don't have any sense of how to work it. I mean, I once directed a lady who had never been in a play in her life, Elizabeth Taylor. I had no problem at all. You'd think she'd been in 100 plays.
How did you work with her?
Just like you work with any actor. You know, I would tell her what I thought the scene was about, and she'd begin working on it, you know. And she was unafraid to do anything.
This is in Little Foxes.
Yeah. And so it's the person. It's not what they've done. If a person is hungry and hot and they really want to work, it doesn't matter what they've been doing.
I've heard some actors say they like working with you as a director,
yeah,
because you've been an actor yourself.
Uh-huh.
But what is it that they're really getting at there? I mean, what is it that you know that a director who maybe hasn't been an actor...
Well, in the first place, there are directors who haven't been actors who know exquisitely how to work with actors. Arvin is a leading example of that. And then there are directors who have been actors who you'd never know it when you work with them. It's just, maybe it's that I'm still an actor. And acting is... At least acting is artistically more important to me than anything else in my life, artistically. And I know the problems. I mean, I still know them because I act at least as often as I direct. And I know what it is to be thrashing about with a scene, and I know you need freedom, and I also know you need real close direction, and you need a weird combination of those two things. And I know that it needs to be made unpleasant for you, and I know it needs to be made pleasant for you all at the same time. And I love actors because I just love actors. If you put a gun to my head and said I had to pick one, I would pick acting. So I have all that. It's like I'm an actor in there with them. But there are some actors I don't think I've helped that much as a director. I mean, every once in a while, it's not even their fault. Sometimes the connection doesn't happen right. And you frustrate them and they frustrate you, and it happens.
Have you ever directed yourself?
Never. A couple of times in New York I've directed plays that have been on for quite a few months, and sometimes after 6 months or so somebody has left them and I've gone into a part. But I've gone in with like a couple of rehearsals, and that's not the same at all as directing yourself through a rehearsal process, which I've never done and which I can't imagine that I would do, although, as President Reagan says, you never say never.
So it's not something you'd like to try.
And I'm not at all drawn to it. I think when you direct a play, you have to direct it. You have to sit there and see it and get the whole picture of what's going on and play with it and see all the elements against each other and get a sense of the music of the production. And I don't know how you could do that if you were also in it in any kind of large role. And what's the point of taking a small role in one of your own productions, you know? And, I mean, you can't sit and watch it every night and figure out, oh, now this is going wrong, but this is not coming along.
Well, you would be someone who wants to control all of it.
Well, except what you would do is you would lose all the control. You wouldn't be in control of your acting because your eye would be looking all over the stage to see everybody else was playing their parts right, which you should not be doing when you're acting. And you should, and then you would lose control as a director because you wouldn't be able to see it. Be out front and see what the audience is seeing, which is what a director's supposed to do. So if you entered into acting and directing in the same production because you were a control freak, you would end up with exactly the opposite result from what you wanted.
Since you've been a director, when you're acting, is it ever difficult for you to kind of give it up?
I love it. One thing that 20 years ago, why did I say that? 8 years ago, I was directing up in a theater in New Hampshire, Olympia Dukakis in the Cherry Orchard. And we were really into it, and it was really exciting and all that. And then I was in the middle of that, I got a call from the Williamstown people, from Nikos Sakharopoulos, saying, in a couple of weeks I'm going to direct the Cherry Orchard, and I want you to play Trofimov, the student, and which I'd already played at Nikos's some years before with Olympia, oddly. It all gets very incestuous. And I said, well, Nikos, I'm directing it now. And he said, I know, but you open that, and then you come over here, and you play in my production. And I thought, this is the test. This is the ultimate test. If I can just enter in, because I've just directed it, and I had a real specific way of looking at it as a director. And I was proud of what we were accomplishing, which one is not always when one directs, but I was then. And now I knew that his whole vision of the play would be different from mine.
So did you do it?
Yeah. I said, I wonder if I can just, and I opened the show in New Hampshire. I got in a car. I drove across New England. I got to Williamstown. I went into rehearsal for Trofimov, and I said, I've got to see now if I can let it all go and just be a part of his production without thinking, what's he doing with that moment? What's he doing with that? And I did. But also the reason is I really like that. I like to give myself over. I mean, I'm not to something, you know. So I think it's easier for me than it would be for some people. I mean, I really have the temperament of an actor much more than the temperament of a director.
Do you see every sleeping person and every yawn?
When I'm as a director in the audience and I sit there and I look around the audience while the play is going on, my eye always falls on someone who's asleep or in some way or another unhappy, you know.
Can you enjoy a play like a regular person, or are you always working from your chair in the audience?
That's a good question. I probably, even when I enjoy it, even when I'm swept away by it, part of what I'm swept away by is an awareness of what they're doing. So, yeah, I'm always a little bit working, yeah, I guess. But sometimes it's very exhilarating if it's something you like. Because you think, oh, God, look at the kind of work that it's possible to do if you just try to get it together.
Does it ever feel funny that when you're in a play, you don't get to see the play?
No. What feels funny is that there's no record of it. It doesn't exist anymore when it's over. It's a piece of work you've done, and there's no like library of your work.
Do you think that's a reason that doing some television or screen work appeals to you?
Yeah, that plus the money. I've never had a part either on television or in the movies that was as interesting to me as almost any part I've played in the theater. You know, so I feel kind of, well, it's for the money. I mean, I would feel a different way if I got some parts that I really, really, really engaged me deeply. But the way almost any part that I do in the theater in the last number of years has done. Because in the theater, since you're not paid that much in the theater and because there's no permanent record of it, if the part does not really engage me, I just don't do it.
You've just done the American premiere of Fathers and Sons at Long Wharf Theater in New Haven. Are critics harder on premieres or easier on them?
I don't know that I know a pattern there. I mean, I feel I wouldn't like to be a critic. I mean, I think you just got all that impacted energy, having to receive and receive and receive, would drive me crazy.
So you're the you like
see,
to be
the
one.
See, it's easy for me because I get to create all the time. I get to make energy go out from me, both as an actor and as a director. So I don't know what that's like to be a critic, you know. And I think it would be very exhausting, particularly since there's a lot of work in the theater that isn't very good. And if you don't attend the theater all the time, you tend to see things that are more interesting than you don't see a lot of the just horrible stuff that the critics have to sit through, and just to sit there and take that. And therefore what happens to them is that they so hope that they're going to have an evening that kind of lifts them out of this trough of cynicism that they're in, that then when an evening almost makes it but doesn't quite, it just drives them wild. And they think, why didn't they make it go all the way? What is the matter with those people? And they get angrier at it than they should, and they get unfair to it. And they take a piece that is actually perhaps extremely valid, that could mean a lot to a lot of people, but because it isn't quite right, they get incredibly frustrated with it. And I think maybe that's how that happens. It's not that they're bad people. Well, some of them are, but there are bad people in every line of work. So what are you going to do?
Thanks for coming in.
Well, it was my pleasure.
My guest has been Austin Pendleton. His production of Brian Friel's Fathers and Sons is currently at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with TV news anchor David Brinkley. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Cynthia Heimel tells us why, for her, 1990 can't get here fast enough. Heimel deals with the complexities of love in the 80s in her columns in Playboy and The Village Voice. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward explains why the Belmonts were more than just those guys who sang doo-wop behind Dion in the 60s. And Michael Chabon's first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, has been getting a lot of notice these days. We'll find out what book critic John Leonard thinks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. One passenger from a hijacked Kuwaiti airliner has been released by his captors, but at least 95 others are still on the jumbo jet at an airport in northeastern Iran, and the hijackers have set a 12-hour deadline for their demands to be met. Jim Muir reports.
According to the Jordanian passenger who was freed, there are five or six hijackers armed with pistols and hand grenades. He said they tied up the passengers and put them at the back of the plane. The official Iranian news agency said the hijackers are demanding the release of 17 Iranian-inspired Islamic radicals serving prison sentences in Kuwait for bomb attacks on the American and French embassies there in 1983. The Kuwaitis have made it clear they won't give in to the demand, and they're looking to the Iranian authorities to bring a swift and peaceful end to the drama. Tehran has dispatched a high-ranking official to Mashhad to conduct the negotiations. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Nicosia, Cyprus.
American photographer Conan Owen was sentenced to 6 years in a Spanish prison today on charges of cocaine trafficking. The 23-year-old Owen was convicted despite U.S. Justice Department support of his claim that he was duped into carrying cocaine into Spain. The suburban Washington, D.C. man has already spent a year in a Barcelona prison waiting for his trial. The Justice Department today said it will continue to work to free Owen, who was once a White House photography intern. U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz traveled to Syria tonight in the latest stage of his peace mission. He held talks earlier in the day with Jordan's King Hussein as part of a five-country tour of the Middle East. NPR's Deborah Amos reports that an interview held by Shultz has provoked some controversy.
The U.S. Secretary of State gave a press conference for Jordanian newspaper editors before leaving for Damascus. They asked him pointed questions about the U.S. government's willingness to press Israel on the Territories for Peace formula. It's the basic requirement for Jordanian approval of the peace process. Shultz told them there would be no prospect that the U.S. would press Israel, but said the U.S. would work towards a just and sensible solution to the tensions. Shultz told the editors that returning to the borders before the 1967 war was not in the cards. His comments so angered Jordanian officials that, according to sources here, the interview was not broadcast on Jordanian television, and the editors were given a directive by government officials not to publish Shultz's comments. In Amman, this is Deborah Amos.
Paul Simon evaded questions today about the future of his Democratic presidential campaign. Campaigning in Wisconsin, Simon was asked about reports that he plans to suspend his campaign after today's Wisconsin primary.
Wisconsin is very crucial.
How crucial?
Very crucial.
Would you drop out?
We're going to do well tonight. If we don't do well, we have to make a reevaluation.
Simon reportedly has told his associates he plans to suspend his campaign rather than withdraw from the race so he can keep the delegates he's already won. Michael Dukakis appears headed for a narrow victory over Jesse Jackson in the Colorado caucuses held yesterday. Jackson has complained that a slow count of caucus returns may have hurt him in today's Wisconsin primary, where polling is still taking place. Police in Japan today raided three companies suspected of selling China sensitive electronic devices capable of military use. The sale would be a violation of an international agreement limiting strategic exports to the communist bloc. The police searched the offices of two small Tokyo-based export firms and the headquarters of Japan's fifth-largest telecommunications equipment manufacturer, where the seven high-tech devices allegedly sold to China were made. American air carriers are doing a better job of arriving on time. The Transportation Department reports that in February, flights were on schedule 75% of the time. That's an improvement over the 69% showing in January. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 16 points, closing at 1997.51. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Doo-wop was the glue that held together much of the pop music of the 50s and early 60s. Today, rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of three guys who, he says, did it better than most.
The rock and roll artists I feel sorriest for are not the ones you might expect, the talented ones who never made it. Oh, I feel sorry for them, of course, but what must be worse is to be what I call an and the. You know, like Martha and the Vandellas or Shep and the Limelights. It's rare enough that we learn Martha or Shep's last name, but only the most committed trivia buff could name a Vandella or a Limelight. As often as not, this is because the and the's come and go. They're interchangeable and exist mostly to focus attention on the big name. But right off the top of my head, I can think of a very notable exception to this rule.
No, I love you like I do.
No.
Don't know why I love you, don't know why I care. I just want your love to share. I wonder why I love you like I do. Is it because I think you love me too? I wonder why I love you like I do, like I do.
Dion and the Belmonts were the first white vocal group to really absorb the black vocal group tradition and make it their own. Dion DiMucci himself was born to be in showbiz. His dad had a group called the Martin Brothers that played resorts and supper clubs, and Dion had been singing since he was five. As a young boy, he'd been profoundly influenced by Hank Williams, but as a teenager, it was the street corner singing of black kids that held his ear. Dion's first shot at the big time was with a group called the Timberlanes, but their record, The Chosen Few, never got anywhere. In 1957, he found three guys from his neighborhood near Belmont Avenue in the Bronx, Fred Milano, Angelo Dalio, and Carlo Mastrangelo, and Dion and the Belmonts were born. As you could hear a minute ago on their first record, I Wonder Why, the four singers functioned well as a group, and the Belmonts also offered solid accompaniment for Dion's voice. Their career really took off after they'd come back from the disastrous Winter Dance Party tour of 1959. They'd fooled around with that other famous and the group, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, until Holly's famous fatal plane crash. Laurie Records, for whom Dion and the Belmonts recorded, kept giving them terrible songs to record, but managed to score with this one in the spring of 1959.
Each time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart, 'cause I'm so afraid that we will have to part. Each night I ask the stars up above, why must I be a teenager in love? One day I feel so happy.
Teenager in Love, Dion later told an interviewer, was considered a, quote, faggy, unquote, song back in the Bronx. So heaven knows what his peers thought when they heard their version of Rodgers and Hart's Where or When. By 1960, Dion and the Belmonts were Splitsville. Dion had acquired a mighty heroin habit that would take him another 8 years to beat. But during that time, he would make a lot of fine music, including some of the best of the teen idol pop of the era. After that came the classic Abraham, Martin & John, and perhaps the definitive version of Tom Waits' Looking for the Heart of Saturday Night. These days, he records only contemporary Christian material, and his voice is as good as ever. And the Belmonts? Well, judging from their subsequent career, maybe it was their taste that was kind of lame, since they went on to record one more decent record, Tell Me Why, before dropping onto the supper club circuit.
Tell me why the stars in the sky are the same kind of
But that's a hard judgment to make. The bottom line was, these guys liked to sing, and they sang very well, which is maybe why they did sticky arrangements of standards. All I know for sure is that they got together in 1971 to record one of the most beautiful albums of all time.
I'm through with my own love. I loved her through and through. I'm searching for a new love. Can that new love be you?
The album was called Cigars Acapella Candy, and it featured only their three voices, occasionally enhanced by the miracle of overdubbing, in arrangements by Bob Feldman and Belmont Fred Milano, singing everything from Stevie Wonder's Loving You Is Sweeter Than Ever to their old favorite, Where or When. But the masterpiece is this selection, nearly 5 minutes long, in which they go through every street corner dip, dip, and bomb, bomb, calling it Street Corner Symphony. It summed up an era in breathtaking fashion, while it also reminded us of Dion and the Belmonts.
Wah, 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 wah. Oh, bah, 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 bah.
Is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is humorist Cynthia Heimel. Her work appears regularly in The Village Voice and Playboy magazine. In her book, Sex Tips for Girls, she offers irreverent advice on such topics as sex, of course, curing a broken heart, and surviving the great American boyfriend crunch. Heimel's new book includes the script of her off-Broadway play, A Girl's Guide to Chaos, along with commentaries and observations on the uncharted course for women in the 80s. Well, the 80s are almost over, so I asked Cynthia Heimel if she's relieved.
Well, I think the 80s have been hard on everybody. You know, it's, I don't know if it's the, is there such a harmonic convergence, I believe it's called.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been, people have lost money, people have just kind of come under it in some way or another. And, you know, the me decade, the greed decade, we're tired. We want to just have a nice, sweet decade now.
Well, how different has this decade been from the last half dozen decades?
Well, you know, as I said in my books, I should have, in my many books. Oh, here's one now. In the 20s, we were, you know, did the Charleston, bobbed our hair, danced around. We knew what we were supposed to do. We had plenty of suitors. In the 30s, we, you know, were cheerful and tried to get jobs, and the stock market crashed. So we knew then what we were supposed to do. In the 40s, we, you know, we worked for the war effort. In the 50s, we had patios and Japanese lanterns, and, you know, it was all kind of the man in the gray flannel suit. And in the 60s, well, we know what we did in the 60s. We're not telling. and then 70s, we became feminists. And in the 80s, we really didn't know what to do anymore. You know, we had no idea. There's no role models for what women are faced with nowadays. We can't look backwards and say, well, I'm going to be like, you know, Claire Booth Luce, because we don't really want to be like anybody in the past.
Well, you said once this is the decade where you figured out the Myrna Loy way of being.
Right.
Which is what?
Well, whenever I'm too stupid or depressed or manic to, you know, use my own personality, which is normally okay, my own personality, but every once in a while I'm just, you know, too angry with a lover or just too strung out, I just try and focus on Myrna and think, what would Myrna do in a situation like this? And it really works. It's kind of, you know, loyalty can flood over your body and make you calm and make you say witty, smart, wonderful things instead of the normal things you say in situations like that, which is, after all I've done for you, look how you treat me, which is really a bad idea.
And it works?
Yeah. I mean, I noticed that when I got angry with my boyfriend, I would open my mouth and turn into my mother. And that is never a good thing to happen in the middle of a fight, you know. And if you say, what have I done to deserve this, people will tell you. And, you know, you're already in a bad mood and you don't want to hear that.
You've talked about all this for years in your stories and your essays, and then you did a play, A Girl's Guide to Chaos. What made you want to do that?
I didn't. But Wynn Hanman, the director of the American Place Theater, phoned me up and said, have you ever thought about doing theater? And I said, no, and I'd never heard of him. Of course, he's this big, famous guy, but I know so little about the theater. And he said, please send me all your work. And then he called 3 months later and said, could you please send me all your work? And another month later, could you please just send me? And eventually we got together and, you know, used some of my work as a basis. And then I wrote dialogue and turned my generic characters into actual, you know, sort of flesh and blood type characters. We put it on in a basement at the American Place Theater, and it did really well, so we moved it up to the main stage.
So where did you sit on opening night?
Well, we were in the basement on opening night, I guess, and I was sitting behind John Simon, the critic, and not far away from Stephen Holden, another critic.
Were you watching their faces?
Of course. I never looked at the stage for a second. And I remember John Simon's date was this sort of meek woman who every time she wanted to laugh, looked at him first to make sure he was laughing. And I wanted to go up to her and say, come on! Stop it.
Did you have that fantasy that after opening night, you'd walk into a local restaurant and all the diners would burst into applause when you walked through the door?
No. I had that fantasy too long ago when I had my first piece published in the Soho Weekly News. You know, I thought everybody's going to know me. I'm going to walk in and people are just going to say, aren't you Cynthia Heimel? And it never happened. So I never, actually I got more attention for doing a play than I've ever gotten before in my life.
Did you like that?
I kept feeling like turning around and looking to see who was behind me because I just couldn't believe all the fuss. It was only momentary. I mean, I don't want to say, you know, it's still going on or boy, am I a big shot, but for a couple weeks there, I was, you know, doing real well, and, you know, everybody said, oh, yes, you're, and I was amazed by it. I encourage people who want a lot of attention to write plays.
You've also done stories on women for Playboy. I was pretty intrigued with your story about you feeling like the only person on earth who doesn't love Marilyn Monroe.
You know, I got a lot of letters in response to that. And very few of them were negative. I think that Marilyn Monroe herself was not someone that I hated, but the what she elicited from men was really appalling. A basic look that I saw in all her movies was, if I play my cards right, I might trick her into letting me have sex with her. And she was just such a quintessential doe caught in the glare of headlights that it made me crazy.
What women do you love right now?
Let's see. Well, I do like Cher. I know there's people going, Cher, ugh, she's disgusting. Ugh, she's had all that plastic surgery. But she's so feisty. She's such a wise ass. She's so sort of captain of her own ship that I really like her. I enjoy women who are not victimized, and there's so much in the movies of women being victimized, even to this day.
I just saw an old copy of a story you wrote for Cosmopolitan on how to flirt. You know, here we are 5 years later, and I'm wondering if the rules for that have changed.
That actually was an excerpt from Sex Tips.
Oh, yeah, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, have the rules changed?
For flirting? No. Flirting is still a very nice, invigorating thing to do, and no, the rules haven't changed. You know, it's still kind of feel good about yourself. Hey, I'm great. And not worry about what your hair looks like. And if your hair's really a mess, don't even try to flirt, because you won't be able to.
So what's the latest with the boy-girl scene in New York these days? Is there a trend going on at the moment?
Well, a lot of people are getting married. Otherwise, a lot, you know, there's nobody is having sex. That sounds like a contradiction. But people who are just single and sort of knocking around are not having any casual sex, and we can understand why. There's not a big dating scene. I'm sure I haven't ever been to a singles bar except once in my life. And I don't know if they're still there, but, you know, I'm sure nobody's really going to them. Or else people are getting married and having babies. I think babies are the Cuisinarts of the 80s.
Yeah.
They're like these major accessories, you know. People are buying $400 strollers for them and, you know, $600 hand-knitted sweaters, and there's all these magazines out.
So as this decade winds down to a close, after all these essays over the years from you, you think you've got this great boyfriend crunch thing figured out?
No, not at all. No, now I have to start thinking about, well, what happens now when you start, you know, aging? I don't want to say like I'm getting old, but I do have a 17-year-old son, and I'm in my late 30s, so I'm thinking, oh, no, this is a new one that I have to deal with. You know, what do I do now? Now I'm like this old broad. So the boyfriend crunch thing is never going to be settled by one woman in one moment of time. But I do think that women will eventually settle down into their new roles and feel a lot better. And men will be able to settle down a little bit more, too.
Cynthia Heimel is a regular columnist for The Village Voice and Playboy magazine. Her new book, A Girl's Guide to Chaos, is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and find out what's going on. Renee, what are you working on?
Well, we have a report tonight on the ousting of Arizona Governor Evan Meekum. It wasn't unexpected, but it did happen finally last night. Also, two views on power broker Roy Cohen. There are now two books out, one's authorized, one's not, about Roy Cohen, who you might have, along with me, I certainly thought this, that Roy Cohen kind of disappeared when Joe McCarthy did back in the early 50s.
Right.
He didn't. He was a power broker right until virtually till he died. And while he lived a double life.
Interesting. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Twenty-four-year-old Michael Chabon wrote his first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, as his master's thesis at the University of California at Irvine. This was just last year. His professor liked it and sent it to his agent in New York. She liked it and sold it. Michael Chabon's first novel has just been published. Book critic John Leonard likes it, too.
First of all, I love the title. If you're going to write a first novel about a young man coming of age in what most of us think of as maybe the least romantic of American cities, calling it The Mysteries of Pittsburgh is funny. Second, I love the opening sentence, quote, "At the beginning of the summer, I had lunch with my father, the gangster, who was in town for the weekend to transact some of his vague business." Third, I even love the chapter headings, "The Evil Love Nurse," "Searchlights and Giant Women," "The Beast That Ate Cleveland." And finally, just listen to this passage early on in Michael Chabon's ingratiating novel. "Then my father asked me what my plans were for the summer, and in the flush of some strong emotion or other, I said, 'It's the beginning of the summer, and I'm standing in the lobby of a 1,000-story grand hotel, where a bank of elevators a mile long and an endless row of monkey attendants in gold braid wait to carry me up, 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 through the suites of moguls, of spies, and of starlets, to rush me straight to the Zeppelin mooring at the Art Deco summit, where they keep the huge dirigible of August tied up and bobbing in the high winds. On the way to the shining needle at the top, I will wear a lot of neckties, I will buy 5 or 6 works of genius on 45 RPM, and perhaps too many times I will find myself looking at the snapped spine of a lemon wedge at the bottom of a drink. I anticipate a coming season of dilated time and of women all in disarray. And so we are off with young Art Beckstein on a journey into sexual differentiation the summer after his graduation from college. If what I've quoted sounds to you a lot like F. Scott Fitzgerald, it does so to me too. The great world looked at through a lens of lollipop and rendered as a sort of lyric wound. Art himself is full of the same sort of smarty-pants innocence Amory Blaine was full of in This Side of Paradise. But his tone of voice, talking about himself, has the ironic evasiveness of Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby. Art is telling us about the wonderful monsters at whose banquet he was a guest, in a land as fabulous as Fitzgerald's Long Island. Instead of a valley of ashes, we visit in Chabon's Pittsburgh the Lost Neighborhood and the Cloud Factory. If Art's father is a gangster, well, really, so was Gatsby. The wonderful monsters Art meets are a girl in the college library, a flower child with the name of Phlox, and Arthur LeCompte, a golden and witty homosexual charmer, and the self-destructive Cleveland, poet, alcoholic, Hell's Angel, and collector for loan sharks. Both Phlox and Arthur are in love with Art. Art, whose confusion about his own sexual identity seems remarkably healthy, will choose Arthur with some Baroque misgivings. For this, unreasonably, Art's wrathful Old Testament father will punish Cleveland with a death that's far too symbolic. Except for Art, these characters aren't quite as interesting as the author wants them to be, although each is a nice idea. But we don't care. We are caught in the snares of language as its own romance, language in love with its own images, bursting to glitter like the jewels in Cleveland's doll when the helicopter comes to shoot him down. The man came to write and does so gloriously.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Cleve Jones, founder of the Names Project, which inspired and organized the sewing of a giant quilt in memory of AIDS victims. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the score for the ballet The Lady with the Lapdog by the Russian composer Rodin Chedrin. The ballet was performed at the recent Soviet-American Music Festival in Boston. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss the place of Western literature in today's curriculum. Stanford University recently amended its noted Western culture requirement, and 2 recent books on the subject have become bestsellers. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Diane Orson, Ed Dougherty, and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Ruth Harold, Gavin Morrison, and Carol Jewett. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.